Okay, so welcome everybody to this webinar event on social unrest in Colombia and Chile, causes and cures. My name is Gareth Jones. I'm director of the Latin America and Caribbean Center, which with the School of Public Policy at the LSE is co-host of this event. I'm very pleased to be chairing and happy to welcome an amazing range of speakers for this, Professor Ana Arjona, Dr. Marcelo Rios, Dr. Mauricio Cárdenas, and the LSE's very own Professor Andres Velasco. Before I do more formal and extensive introductions to each of the speakers, let me just tell people that this event is being recorded. And will be available subsequently as a podcast on various media through the LSE, through the School of Public Policy, through the Latin America and Caribbean Center. You can also follow the event through Twitter on hashtag LSE Public Policy. And once the presentations and dialogue amongst the panelists is completed, there'll be an opportunity. I'll open the floor to questions from the audience. So please use the Q&A function on Zoom, and I will do my best toward the end to relate those questions to the panelists generally or specifically, and we can have a wider conversation about this really important topic. If I introduce each of the speakers in the order in which they will actually be presenting, Ana Arjona obtained her PhD in political science from Yale University and is presently associate professor at the Department of Political Science at Northwestern University in the United States. She was the director of the Center for the Study of Security and Drugs at Los Andes University in Bogota in Colombia in 2018-2019, and is still an associate researcher at Los Andes. Her research investigates the dynamics and legacies of organized violence, especially civil wars and organized crime, local governance, and the foundations of political order. And she's well known for her award-winning book, Rebelocracy, Social Order in the Colombian Civil War, which was published by Cambridge in 2016, which proposes a theory to explain order and disorder in war zones, as well as the form order takes when it emerges, giving place to different forms of rebel governance. She's currently working on different projects on individual and collective behavior in contexts where non-state armed groups operate, as well as on the legacies of organized violence and militarized governance. Marcelo Rios is the assistant resident representative in Chile for the United Nations Development Programme, UNDP. She received master's and doctoral degrees in political science from the University of Wisconsin, and has a master's degree from Flaxo in Mexico. She has interests in Latin American comparative politics and in gender studies. Dr. Mauricio Cárdenas is a recognized expert on Latin America and an economist with a vast portfolio of academic and policymaking experience. He's presently visiting professor at Columbia University SIPA, a member of the task force led by Michael Bloomberg on ways to use taxation to improve health outcomes, and is a distinguished fellow at the Center for Global Development in Washington, DC. His academic experience is also associated with Fede Desarrollo in Colombia, where he has been executive director twice, and with the Brookings Institution. As Colombia's Minister of Finance between 2012 and 2018, he handled the oil shock and its aftermath, implementing a successful adjustment program that preserved high investment rates and a sharp reduction in poverty and inequality. And in addition to having been Minister of Finance, He's held the portfolio of Minister for Economic Development, for Transport, for Planning, and Mines and Energy. Lastly, Andres Velasco is presently Professor of Public Policy and Dean of the School of Public Policy at LSE. He was previously, from 2006 to 2010, Minister of Finance in Chile, has held professorial roles at Harvard Kennedy School and Columbia University, and in 2006 received the Award for Excellence in Research from the Inter-American Development Bank, 2015-16 co-chaired the Global Panel on the future of multilateral lending institutions, and 2017-18 he was a member of the G20 Eminent Persons Group. I believe, unless my LinkedIn is deceiving me, that he's also just published or about to publish a book on macroeconomics, and I'm sure that will form part of some discussion in the ether sphere of the LSE in the very near future. So we have this set up essentially as two political scientists being responded to by two economists, which I'm intrigued as to how that will work out. So without further ado, let me pass the microphone to the first speaker, Anna, and then we'll move straight to Marcela. Anna, over to you.
Thank you, Gareth. Can you see my screen? Okay, perfect. So thank you for the invitation and thank you for everyone who's joining this conversation. So I'll be very brief. And my goal is to have a very brief overview of social unrest in Colombia, especially in the last 2 years, and then try to think about what can explain this massive unrest, and finally a few ideas about moving forward. So let me start with a brief overview. The first thing to notice is that social protests in Colombia started to increase around 2007. There were different types of social movements that were on the streets of different sectors of the population. But what happened in 2019 was really unprecedented. So that's when massive mobilization of different sectors of the population started to go out to the streets. Then what happened in the summer of 2021 was even larger and even more unprecedented, in part because it really got together different sectors of both the urban and rural populations with very different agendas. The other important novelty of this last episode of social unrest is the participation of young people. And this is the first generation that didn't grow up, at least in their adolescent years, with the armed conflict, but with the promise of peace. And I think that is crucial to understanding the scope and the demands of this unrest, of these protests. There were numerous demands in these protests. So there were many agendas that were sort of emerging on the streets. There was opposition to specific policies, including tax reform, economic reform. There was a demand for the implementation of the peace agreement that was signed between the government and the guerrilla group FARC in 2016. There was demand for more social protection systems, especially healthcare and accessible education. There were demands for better environmental policy, for police reform, for protection of social leaders who have been assassinated in Colombia increasingly after the mobilization of the FARC, the signing of the peace agreement. And also there was a demand of implementation of agreements that the state had made with students, indigenous, Afro-Colombian communities, teachers, and youth movements in the past, and that had not been honored. So as I said before, there was this massive participation of different sectors of the population. And just to give you some very general and a brief description of the process, it was mostly peaceful by all counts, but there were serious violent events that ended up with deaths, destruction of infrastructure, destruction of property. There were incidents of attacks and blockages to ambulances and healthcare providers. There were difficulties for transporting food and basic supplies around the country. And of course, local economies and livelihoods were impacted. At the same time, the response of the state was really violent. There was a general criminalization of protests. There was a lot of police brutality and militarization. Dozens of people were killed. There's more than 100 disappeared persons during the protests, several cases of sexual violence, and many wounded people, especially young protesters. There was all these also systematic attacks on journalists. So let's turn now to thinking about why are we seeing this now? Basically, the argument that I'll develop in the next 6 minutes is that most of these grievances, or maybe all of them, have a very long history in the country, at least since the 1950s. The pandemic exacerbated many of them, and the pandemic also showed in a crude and very visible way how unequal these effects are and how different sectors of the population are going to bear the cost to very different extents. It also showed the failures of the state and the weakness of the current government. But in the last few years, people also really started to expect something different, to think that something different was possible, that they were entitled to demand it. And I think that is crucial to understand it, to understanding why now people are making all these claims and really flooding the streets. So let's start with old grievances, and I can't go into each of them. These are things that every expert on Colombia knows. It's one of the most unequal country in the world, and it has been for many decades. Poverty is widespread, and it's been much worse during the pandemic. Actually, we had a couple of decades or 15 years of improvements in poverty levels, but the pandemic has undermined a lot of those gains. It's a country that suffers of political violence, criminal violence, and social violence, including state violence, which is important to take into account. There is a lack of sufficient social protection systems, widespread corruption, environmental degradation. And as I mentioned before, there have been agreements by different governments with different social groups that have not been honored, and people have noticed that. So what about current factors? So of course, the pandemic exacerbated a lot of these things. It increased inequality and also put the spotlight on inequality. It increased poverty, and it affected in particular women and young people. So these two sectors of the population were particularly impacted, which also means that a lot of families that are led by women. Violence against social leaders has increased since the signing of the peace agreement. More than 1,000 leaders have been killed, and the weak implementation of the peace process is another very important factor in the last 5 years that I think have really shaped people's view of the government, people's view of the state, and people's unrest and disagreement with how things are being handled in Colombia. There is a widespread crisis of governance that is very deep and very concerning. There is a widespread lack of trust in institutions, very weak identification with political parties, so people don't feel that political parties can really represent them, which really undermines democracy and the trust in the democratic process. There is a low approval for the current government, and there is low support for democracy, as is the case in most of Latin America. So citizens don't really think that democracy is that important. It's more important to getting things done. And that can be really problematic, not just for the danger for democracy, but also for how people consider their alternatives, ways of action and of participation. What I want to emphasize here, that I think has not been usually a focus of discussion and analysis, is that because grievances have had this very long history, something must have happened for people to actually go now to the streets. I think these massive protests mean that people think that they can and that they should demand more. So something changed. And I think there are a few factors that can help us understand what changed. The first one is the peace agreement. So there were new ideas discussed for years about how things could and should change. And I think these really shaped in different ways, shared beliefs and expectations. And I'm gonna talk just about a few of the things that I think discussions around the peace agreement changed. One is the idea that peace was possible, that it really was possible after 50 years of trying to have agreements, especially with the FARC that became the strongest guerrilla movement. So peace is possible, and we should demand the protection of physical rights and of human rights. The right of human, of physical security and human rights. The idea is they should be doing much more. So the peace agreement included a lot of policies, a lot of commitments for rural development, which includes bringing the state to these areas, thinking of different ways for developing these local economies and for really including populations that have been traditionally excluded from the country. A different take on drug policy. The peace agreement also included very specific policies to ensure political participation and peaceful opposition, and the idea that these rights should be protected by the state and that it is good for democracy, that there can be opposition and protest, and that it's one of the roles of the state to make sure that this is always protected and ensured. And I also think there was a shared idea that because opposition and political participation should be protected, people should not be anymore as afraid of going out to the streets, of protesting, especially for the young people. So I think there was this pedagogical value of the peace agreement in having the country talk about these ideas and talk about these changes in a way that just didn't happen before. Lower levels of violence, I think this is another critical point. I think right now Colombians feel really desperate with the violence that we are enduring, but at the same time, we are now in a moment where we're living the lowest level of violence in the last four decades. And I'm just showing here some data from the National Police and the Forensic Agency in Colombia, showing that really violence has been going down, and especially since the signing of the peace agreement, people feel a different level of security. And they dreamt with a country that was really at peace, or at least that didn't endure the kinds of violence that it has endured for decades. Counterintuitively, I think that a war that was waged in the name of social justice by guerrilla groups prevented inequality from being one of the top priorities for presidential campaigns, for debates around public policy, and for voters. After the demobilization of the FARC, inequality finally became a really focal point. And I think that really changed a lot of the conversations that people were having, a lot of the expectations for what new administrations should be doing, and especially again for the youth. This idea that the levels of inequality in Colombia are simply just not acceptable and that they need to change. And then finally, the pandemic, I think, meant a radical change for people, as we all know, a lot of uncertainty on very different domains of life. It was a shock on the social and economic order. And I think this can really create fertile grounds for change in Colombia and in the world. And we are seeing a lot of this happening, right? There are a lot of areas where people are now realizing that things could be different. And I think this adds to everything else that I said before. This is like a different mental mindset that allows people to think differently and to act differently. So looking forward, and I'll just take 1 or 2 minutes on this, I think we need deep reforms to establish solid social protection systems, long-term policies to reduce inequality, police reform is a must, and the implementation of the peace agreement. And this is something, again, that every expert on Colombia knows. I'll just emphasize one thing. Some of the challenges ahead for trying to implement these policies are, of course, that political incentives usually are at odds with long-term reforms. Governments want to do things that they can show at the end of their term. Populism is thriving in the region, in the world. And opposition by strong elites to all these measures has always been present in Colombia. But in the same way that a lot of things have sort of changed the mindset of the general public, maybe they have also changed the mindset of the elites, because the social unrest was really scary for the elites. And maybe this will allow them to realize that unless things change, a different kind and more difficult social unrest can happen. It's to continue in this pedagogical sort of approach where we really need a dialogue and broad participation. I think it's the only way to be able to launch these reforms and implement them. So we need to educate the public and listen to the public, to different sectors of the population. And I think it's really important to consider how these ideas can really get to everyone in the country. And I think it's crucial to really start from the bottom up, engaging with grassroots movements that can really foster a broad understanding of the reforms and the idea that we need long-term projects, long-term changes, and not just short-term and populist solutions. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Okay, my turn. I just wanted to thank for the invitation, the London School of Economics, the Public Policy Department, Andrés Velasco in particular. I'm really glad to be here discussing such relevant issues with you. I'm gonna take my time so that I don't go over. Understanding Chile's social revolt, and I think a lot of what Anna just mentioned about Colombia has a lot of coincidence with the process in Chile. First, I wanted to take a look in terms of explaining what was it that we went through from October 18th, 2019, and probably March, around early March into 2020. The revolt didn't really completely disappear until the effects and the measures regarding COVID really hit. So we had, but particularly, the first month was particularly intense, but we continued to have massive protests for, at least 2 or 3 months consecutively. The protest, one of the different things from previous or others, I think that, when you have a huge march or a protest at one point, it's very different than a cycle of protests or of a revolt, like the one that we experienced in Chile. We have had cycles of protests before, but we probably, and there's, discussions among historians of how profound this was, but this is in no doubt one of the largest social revolts in the history of the country. It started, as you may know, by school, high school students who began protesting for the increase of public transportation, particularly the subway. So at the beginning, it was students protesting, not paying the subway dues, and this went on for a few weeks. Authorities ignored them, and they began. The police really repressed the protests, and this began catching on, and they began gathering a lot of public support. Until, and then, one of the interesting things is that this was not the October 18th and the days that followed, this was not something that was concentrated exclusively on the capital city, even though it began due to an increase in public transportation fares in Santiago, it spread throughout the country. And it began to have all sorts of demands that were not really linked to public transportation. It included, pension reform, healthcare, a new constitution, feminist issues, environmental issues, and it spread throughout the country. Relevant thing that this was not sort of an elite kind of middle class or, well-educated people's revolt. At the beginning, it was students, but as this spread, strongest areas of protest and probably the most violent protests took place in the poorest zones of the big cities of Chile. So this was really a multi-class, national, cross-cutting kind of movement that began as the classic social movement theory says you at a tipping point and initial actors trigger this, and then there's this massive kind of protest that spreads to the country. The second thing is that, and I've been working on feminist issues for a long time, and many of you have probably seen the news about the centrality of women in protests. And something that people don't know necessarily is that we had had a feminist uprising at least a year and a half before the social revolt of October, beginning in the middle of 2019 in universities. And once again, this was something that began with students but spread throughout society. And by March 2019, for the commemoration of International Women's Day, we had the biggest feminist gathering in the country's history. We had over a million women in the streets in Santiago, and another million women marching throughout the country way over 10 months before the October revolt. And women have played a central role throughout this process. You know, many of you might have seen the performance by Las Tesis, you know, chanting against the police brutality. This is one of an enactment of Las Tesis' performance outside of the National Stadium, demanding a new constitution with parity, where thousands of women got together with no real central organizational actor convening them. This was a lot of self-convening and social networks and different groups convening march. But women have been, you know, protagonists, and their role within the revolt has had very significant impact also on the process afterwards. But this is a process that's also has had a considerable amount of violence. Chile is different in that sense from Colombia, in the sense that we haven't had political violence in our history, any significant, but we have had increasing criminal violence in the country in the, you know, the last decade. This has been increasing, particularly in poor zones of the country. We have an increasingly violent conflict between the state and indigenous population, particularly the Mapuche people nation in the south, over land tenure, which has never been able to, you know, been institutionally processed. And our protests has systematically ended in violence. And this is something that we sort of carry over from the dictatorship and, you know, a lot of the literature on the repertoires of collective action, I think, show us that in the case of Chile, the violence in street protests has been incorporated as one of the repertoires for action. And the way that the police react to protests, really criminalizing protests, instead of, you know, accepting social protests, has increased this. But this, the violence that occurred in October 2019 was completely different. You know, the protesters burned down at 7 subway stations. They have burned churches down. They also went sacking through all sorts of, you know, commercial, destroying banks, destroying McDonald's, but also, you know, sacking small, you know, little shops of people in standing out, chanting arms. A violence that has continued, even though not as, you know, as strongly as it was at the beginning, but that this is something that has been really present throughout the process. There was also, and this is something I think, a glorification of the role of people who defended you know, protester against the police, something that was called, you know, primera línea, the first line of combat. And there's a lot of, you know, discussion about what the role of these people and who these people were. But they have been very important in sort of the whole sort of symbolic understanding of the process. Finally, and this is something also that is very, very well known, the state reaction in Chile towards protests has always been overhanded. We have had, you know, reports and recommendations from by the Inter-American Human Rights Commissions for decades on an ill-designed legislation in Chile. You cannot, you know, protest in the street without having an administrative permission, which is something that, you know, also the High Commissioner for Human Rights has pointed out in several occasions, that, you know, infringes people's rights to freedom of expression. But also, you know, there's the government declared a state of siege. Militaries were, you know, put on the streets for the first time after the dictatorship, which was symbolically something very significant. And a lot of people thought once the government had, you know, brought out the military, the protests were going to end because of the fear that people have due to the history of the traumatic history during the dictatorship. But that didn't really happen. I mean, that I think that the generation that grew up in democracy, that did not have a memory of lived memory of the dictatorship, really confronted the military, and it turned out that this was sort of putting more fuel into a fire rather than calming things down. And the second dimension, it has been the systematic problem of police brutality, the use of force. And we actually have a new report by the High Commissioner of Human Rights after 2 years, once again saying that all the recommendations regarding the way to deal with protests have not been accepted or worked on. In Amnesty International, America's Human Rights Watch, our own National Institute on Human Rights, there was death, not as many as in other countries, but in Chile, having 7 deaths on one day on political grounds, it's a huge, over 400 victims with severe eye trauma. This has been something that's been very traumatic for society. We have at least very important cases of people who lost complete vision due to, the way that police handle weapons. So this has been also a lot of cases of police brutality, sexual violence within police precincts, police asking young women to take all the clothes once they went arrested, touching them. This has been something, actually the whole performance by Las Tesis was a response to this way of police dealing with protests. But also I think it's important to that the protest was not just violence and repression. There was a whole other dimension that, taking over the public space. We have a museum of the, and you can see there's thousands of paintings, graffiti, these things that I don't know how you call them in English, pegatinas, of all sorts of things that throughout the cities in Chile. And in every protest you had, theater, dancing, painting, a really kind of outburst of creativity and cultural kind of performances. Once again, where women have been completely at the center front, but also a lot of collective action. And the first few months after the revolt, we had spontaneous sort of constitutional assemblies, popular assemblies gathering in plazas, in parks, of people debating about the new constitution, people debating what to do. And this went on for a few months, really massively, until the pandemic hit. So just to finish, one of the things that we talked about a lot in Chile is that this saying by elites that we didn't see it coming. A lot of social science research, particularly in political science and sociology and anthropology, the work that we have done at UNDP, had been showing that this was something that was slowly building up. Not only the frequency and amount of protests was increasing, the legitimacy of contentious politics was growing significantly. We had, and I think one of the problems of how to interpret this is this idea, was it politics or economics? It was both. Trying to think that this, there was a lot of rejection by the traditional elites of the grounding for protest, the reasons for protest, with the argument that Chile is not more unequal than the rest of Latin America. People are not poorer here than in other countries. People are much better off today than they were 30 years ago. So they really didn't, they really don't have reason for being this upset. That was, I think, that one of the whole logic of the establishment to react to this, to this massive protest. But we've seen, what we saw was there was structural inequalities, material and symbolic, profound indignation with abuse, corruption, the cases of corruption, collusion. So it's not a case just of rebelling against an extreme form of neoliberalism. It's not just, which I think, Chile has an extreme form. It's not, the problem is not that we have a capitalist market-oriented economy, is that we have, an extremely neoliberal capitalist-oriented, where social rights have been privatized, and people have to, in a way, you know, provide by their own means, and their future depends on their ability to secure the conditions of living with a really weak social protection base. So, but that would not probably ended up in this massive wave of protests if it hadn't been because of due to the profound weakening of the political system. You know, the, a crisis of representation where there was no capacity by institutions of intermediating interests or representing different sectors of society or addressing, you know, the malaise due to a highly concentrated political system that is not just unequal in terms of socioeconomic, in terms of economics, but we have, and this is probably particularly good to Chile, it's not the same, I think, in bigger Latin American countries where the concentration of the elites is social, cultural, a very homogeneous in one city, in three, you know, a few square miles. They all know each other, they marry with each other, they go to the same schools, to the same universities, and they have, I think, a real difficulty in understanding the way the rest of society works and what people really are claiming for. I think that, and that really has weakening the capacity of representative democracy to move forth. Just to finish, as you know, we're in the midst of this constitutional process that it's an institutional way out of this crisis, but there's many questions regarding this because was it too late? Can an institutional route work when institutions are so weakened as they are in Chile? And can we, you know, make this process work when there's the, when the need for the for participation is broad, but you really have a citizen, you know, massive distrust of institutional mechanisms and politics in general. So I'm just going to leave those questions and maybe we'll have time to address them later.
So I guess I go now, Gareth, right?
Please do. The microphone is yours.
All right. Thank you so much. Well, I'm delighted after these two presentations because they actually are really a good example of what comparative politics can actually provide us with insight and analysis. When former President Lagos and Santos and Andres and myself started talking about this, we did it with a purpose, which was these are two events that seem to be isolated, the social explosions, both in Chile and Colombia. But drawing a parallel and establishing a contrast and identifying similarities, but also differences, would help us understand not only just what happened, but also the way out. And this is the reason for this event. And it's actually a very important issue. In listening to both Ana and Marcela, it is very clear that the two presentations are very similar. Indeed, the photos that were shown by Marcela can actually be photos taken in Colombia. So it is really remarkable and interesting that we're doing this. And the main reason, I think, for the importance of this event is that this is a crisis that is still unfolding, that we don't know what's going to happen next. And what are the next chapters? And kind of like interpreting what could happen. And more importantly, what could be the solution, the cure to this crisis, I think it would be tremendously useful. I would begin by saying that in establishing this parallel, the one aspect that to me is most revealing is that these were two crises that were completely unexpected, that caught governments off guard, which meant, in my way of thinking, that the status quo thought that it was stronger than it actually is. The way of doing things, the system, showed that is less resilient than what actually is happening in our countries. The other aspect that I think is very important is that this happened before the pandemic. So we cannot attribute this to the pandemic. The pandemic exacerbated things, as both Anna and Marcela said. But the pandemic cannot explain this alone. A third element is that the triggers of these explosions are inconsequential. In one case, the increase in the metro fare. In another case, a tax reform presented by the government. A very ill-conceived tax reform, by the way. But governments, of course, immediately retracted, and that didn't change things. So the triggers were just the excuse made this happen. Also, neither of them mentioned this, but I think it's another important aspect, is that the response of governments, sitting governments, was to adopt more progressive social policies, an increase in pensions, an increase in the minimum wage in the case of Chile, in the case of Colombia, subsidies to public universities, free tuition for students of, say, the first 60% of the population, a number of measures. Measures that were adopted fast, and measures that were progressive, but that did not change things. So those responses were ineffective from the point of view of avoiding this type of unrest. The other element that that I think it's very important to highlight, and I think especially in the case of Colombia, is that this is essentially urban. Colombia has had a lot of rural conflict, and most of the conflict that Colombia is known for is essentially rural, associated, of course, with drug trafficking, with the guerrilla warfare. It's a rural phenomenon that we have studied for years, but this is mostly urban, as it's the case in Chile, and the young play a very important role. So a number of remarkable similarities. Let's now discuss a little bit about the differences. In the case of Chile, the escape valve was the drafting, or the convening of a constitutional assembly and the drafting of a new constitution. Whereas in the case of Colombia, the constitution was never mentioned, was not something that became part of the asks of the movement. Another interesting contrast, at least in the initial stages. In the case of Chile, this was a movement against all forms of institutionalized political participation, including, for example, the traditional labor unions. Whereas in the case of Colombia, the negotiators after the social unrest became the traditional labor unions. The traditional labor unions played a role and in some ways appropriated themselves of the social unrest to leverage on this unrest to gain in terms of their own objectives. I'm not sure that's gonna last, but that's something that happened during the social explosion. Traditional labor unions actually gained from this, which is not the case in Chile. And also, I would say that another aspect in which a commonality can be established is that since we both have in Chile and Colombia presidential elections, these movements became an important aspect of that process. And in both cases, and I think this is the most remarkable aspect and the one that I think is more challenging to explain, it's leading in the direction that populism is taking center stage in this political process, in these elections, rather than reform. So it is a little bit of a contradiction that social unrest that is grounded on the basis of inequality, poverty, exclusion, results in an election where the polls are indicating that the candidates that have the highest support are not reformists, are populists, which is, in my way of seeing things, alarming, because we should be able to establish a connection between this social unrest and all the expressions that have been heard in this past 2 years in our both in both of our countries, with a reformist platform that will deal with the more structural issues that are behind these social unrest. And let me finish with a word about the Constitution. Anecdote: When I was called by the press in Santiago to express an opinion about a new constitution for Chile based on the Colombian Constitution, it was always with the expectation that I would say that the Colombian Constitution had been a really serious problem for our country. Whereas I think that regardless of the economic consequences of our constitution that were difficult and were hard to deal with, especially at the beginning, the Colombian Constitution had actually served well Colombia. But in Chile, the Colombianization of Chilean politics is seen as a serious problem and as a reversal, at least by the elites. So I'll stop here and happy to join the conversation again later.
Hello, everyone. Thank you, Mauricio. Thank you, Gareth, Ana, Marcela. Delighted to be joining you and everyone in this conversation. This is a big, difficult, complex set of issues, and we had some appropriately nuanced and subtle presentations initially, and then comments by Mauricio, and I very much welcome that. I want to make three or four points, some of which will express my agreement with points made already, some of which will express some skepticism and mostly doubts. I just want to share what I think are some open issues for which I don't think we have very good answers. First of all, a distinction. At least in the case of Chile, two things happened in October 2019, which are distinct in my mind. There was an amazing outpouring of peaceful protest of different kinds, as Marcela narrated very, very well. And I think one has to view that as a healthy expression of people who want change and who clearly are not happy with this, that, or the other aspect of life. At the same time, there was a massive, deep, lasting, and mostly unprecedented wave of violence. And I think we do not yet have a good explanation for why that happened alongside the other phenomenon. Marcela mentioned that seven subway stations were burned. That's right. But seven were the ones that were completely burned to the ground. There was a dozen others that were firebombed, attacked, and left incapacitated. If you've seen the new subway stations in Santiago, and these are mostly new, they're above ground, they're steel, they're concrete, they are glass, they're not easy to burn down. So the question as to who triggered this kind of mass violence, who had the know-how, and what were the motivations behind that particular kind of violence, I think remains very much an open question. Second point that I want to make is that Mauricio pointed to a number of similarities, and I think clearly it is quite striking that in the two countries, lots of issues seem to be the same. There are more things that look similar than dissimilar. Now that, I think, should make us pause for a second before we attribute everything that is going on to local causes. Because in the same year that Colombia and Chile took to the streets and to some extent went up in flames, so did Ecuador, so did Bolivia. A year before it had happened in Brazil, And if you look around the world, from Hong Kong to Iran and from France to the UK slightly earlier, there had been massive protests, the Gilets Jaunes in France, you know, the massive sort of almost paralyzation of Hong Kong for a few months, et cetera. What is the point that I'm trying to make as a social scientist? If 40 countries around the world go through something pretty similar in a 12 or, you know, 24 month period, there's probably a set of international causes. Or, if the causes are local, you have to tell me why they get triggered, why there's contagion. You know, Mauricio and I understand financial contagion when, you know, the US gets into financial trouble, Brazil and many other countries also get into trouble. What is the political contagion like in this case? Why do we see contagion? Why is it that once Chile takes to the streets, that makes it more likely that Colombia takes to the streets as well? I don't think we have good stories of that or good models of that among social scientists. The third point that I want to make is that, and I think Marcela and Anna got it right here, because they were not monocausal. It is very easy, and many bad articles in the newspapers have been written that say, oh, of course, you know, needless to say, this is all inequality. You know, Chile and Colombia are very unequal countries, and that is a terrible reality. An even more terrible reality is that they've been very unequal for 200 years. And the social scientist in me wants to say, if there's a change in behavior, I need a change in some other variable that explains the change in behavior. And clearly inequality had not been rising. If anything, and we could have the technical debate as to how we measure it, et cetera, but most measures of inequality suggest that inequality had been falling. It hasn't been falling for the last couple of years, to some extent because of the pandemic and the end of the commodity boom, but for the previous decade, it had been falling. So the mechanical equation of inequality and protest is empirically, it has to be wrong. So we need a more subtle story. And I like, both Marcela and Anna recognize this. In the case of Colombia, I thought Anna made a very important point, which I had never heard before, namely that the war took up pretty much all the bandwidth of the national conversation. And once the peace process began, people turn their attention to something else, and that something else may have been inequality. Could be. I've always been a fan of a great piece by Albert Hirschman, my favorite social scientist, written, I don't know, 50 years ago, called The Changing Tolerance for Economic Inequality in the Course of Development. It could well be that something happened that even though inequality was less, at least economic inequality was less, people became less willing to tolerate it. It could be, but we need that account. We don't have that account. The fourth point I want to make is that, as Mauricio pointed out, lots of social organizations, many of them traditional, tried to jump into the fray and say, oh, I'm going to lead this because my social demands are the demands that people are marching for. And if we go down that route, I think we are doing understanding a disservice. And let me point one not so well-known fact about Chile, which I think is very revealing. Shortly after the first wave of protests, the government said in Chile, okay, with whom can we negotiate? Who will sit at the other side of the table? And just as it happened in Colombia, the big unions, CUT in the case of Chile, the teachers union, which is very powerful in both countries, and the No Más AFP movement, which is not a union, but which is a massive social movement against Chile's pension arrangements, those groups said, we are the representatives of the people. We will sit at the table and we will negotiate with the government. And people began saying, of course, they are sitting at the other side of the table. So it must be the case that they are the legitimate representatives of the protesters and that these are the issues that people are concerned with. Well, all three leaders from CUT, from the Colegio de Profesores and from No Más AFP, 6 months later were candidates for Chile's constitutional convention. All three lost and got puny votes, meaning these classical social organizations that I had attempted to seize the representation of the movement, saying it is my cause, whether pensions or this or that, that people are protesting about, that turned out to be completely, completely wrong. And as a result, again, one has to be very, very careful before accepting some of the conventional wisdom. Two more points and I will stop. If I stick to my routine of asking what changed, what are variables, you know, that one could measure out there that seem to have moved in a very sharp direction in the months prior to the protest in both countries, there's one variable that stands out, and that is trust in and legitimacy of institutions. When I was studying social science many years ago, I used to be told that there were three countries in Latin America in which people had high trust in institutions. Those countries were Costa Rica, Uruguay, and Chile. Well, Chile and Colombia today, and there's several sources, Latino Barometer is one, but it's not the only one, are striking in the degree to which nobody trusts any institution. The most obvious cases are political institutions. In Chile, the government, political parties, Congress, the judiciary, and many other state institutions enjoy less than 10% legitimacy or trust. In Colombia, it's pretty much the same. And you don't have to stop at the state. If you look at other private institutions or non-governmental institutions, whether it be unions or business associations or the Catholic Church or the media, nobody believes anyone anymore. Exactly what the causal link is between one and the other remains to be explored, but it strikes me that a political explanation of a political phenomenon may be more appropriate than a purely economic explanation of a political phenomenon. Maybe we have a paradox here. The two speakers are political scientists, and they told us that most of the causes were economic. I'm an economist, and I'm going to tell you that most of the causes are political, or at least that a certain kind of politics in which institutions collapse in their credibility and their ability to mediate social demands must be at the root of what is going on. One last point, it's the obvious question, you know, what is going on and what comes next? And I think there are two big dangers here. Big danger number one is populism. I think every speaker so far has uttered the word, and I will do so too. The fact that you have many people out there who are unhappy does not guarantee that the sources of that unhappiness will necessarily be addressed, because it is very old news that populist politicians of the right, of the left, seize on these opportunities to push their own agendas in ways that can be quite contrary to the interests of people and actually can be quite contrary to the interests of democracy. And in fact, in both countries, we are seeing, Colombia came before this in Chile with Uribe, and in Chile, we're seeing it in on steroids today, the resurgence of the far right, which I view as a very, very toxic, but not entirely surprising phenomenon. When this happened in Chile, I remember having a conversation with a dear friend who is a French social scientist, and he said, oh, what's going on in Chile is perfectly predictable, he said. In France, we had, you know, the 30 glorious years, and then we had May 68. Typically, you have massive unrest after periods of protest. And he added, don't forget that after the protest of May 68, it was not the left that came to power in France. In fact, it was de Gaulle who swept the elections. After, you know, the events of 68 in Berkeley and Cambridge and New York, it was Richard Nixon that won the elections. That is to say, it is not impossible that social unrest and social disorder and street violence of this kind brings forward a very strong right-wing reaction, which in some cases could be a non-fully democratic right-wing reaction. And in Chile, we're seeing today the rebirth of, or maybe the birth, because it's a slightly new phenomenon, a Trumpian right, which is playing the nationalist card, the anti-immigrant card, the anti-woke card. And of course, you know, if you look at the Chilean press this morning, spokesmen for that campaign are telling us that Pinochet's human rights violations were really, you know, not as bad as they seem. I think this is a terrible, terrible prospect But we have to be vigilant because in other situations, social unrest of this kind has taken us precisely down that route. And that, at least in my mind, is a very bad route indeed. Thank you, Gareth.
Thank you, Andres and Mauricio, for some wonderful comments and synthesis and provocations to two fantastic presentations from Anna and Marcela. I'm very conscious of time, so I'd like to invite sort of Anna for 5 minutes or so and Marcela for 5 minutes or so to respond if there are particular points from Mauricio and Andres that you'd like to pick up. But at the same time, I'd like to overburden you with a couple of questions from the chat and elsewhere. And I'm going to leave perhaps the big question, which has already been touched upon, to the end. So you can put your career on the line, particularly with the last question that I will come up with. First question, and please don't feel obliged to tackle all of these. Choose from the menu. Andres has touched upon it, but there's been a question about the sort of material destruction that these protests sort of generated, targeted, and in many ways sort of celebrated. And I just wonder, particularly perhaps Anna, if you could kind of comment upon how in the Colombia case, that sort of destruction really played a role. Why was there so much attention to the sort of material conflict of these protests? Another question that's come through and perhaps also relates to Andres's point about contagion. In either case, is there any evidence of conversations and dialogues and learning, if you like, between the Colombia and the Chilean protests at any level? Is there any interlocution there or with elsewhere, rather than being sort of grounded up in isolation? There's a question which, again, perhaps relates both to Mauricio's comments and to Andres's, which is, you know, as social scientists, have we underestimated the role of emotion? And what role, therefore, is emotion playing in the generation and also in the process, if you like, of these protests? It's sort of touched upon by Marcela in some of her comments, but I wonder if perhaps either of you have a role, a comment or an examination on that. I'm drawn to this idea of kind of in security studies, which I'm familiar with, that we're talking here about polypandemic, this sort of multi-layering and interface of the COVID pandemic with a violence and conflict pandemic with a political lack of representation, etc. Are we also seeing here the emergence in Latin America of kind of poly-protest? Rather than sort of single agenda protests, etc., we're getting a real kind of melange of protests. And what's that telling us about the crisis of representation? And lastly, and with an eye to the next session at 6 o'clock with former presidents Santos and Lagos, perhaps, how is this playing out in the November elections in Chile? I think Andres has touched upon that, but very specifically, perhaps, how does Anna think that this will play out in its implications for the 2022 elections in Colombia? So Anna, if you'd like 5 minutes or so to tackle that, and then Marcela at the same.
Sure, thank you. Okay, so let me pick a few of these questions. So the first one on violence in Colombia, I think, as it is always the case with our multiple forms of violence, it was quite complicated, and I don't think there is one simple explanation for why there was violence in the protests. I think in some cases, the different kinds of armed organizations that are in Colombia did exploit the opportunity to use more violence and to mobilize people into violence. So that's part of it. I definitely think it was, the scale of it was really smaller than the government tried to make it seem in order to criminalize the entire protest. But of course it was there, and armed actors in Colombia are present in many places, and they play very important roles in a lot of these communities beyond victimizing them. They have power, they have authority, they have the coercive power to mobilize, they have influence. They want to recruit young people. I mean, there are a number of interests that can help us understand why these groups try to exploit the social unrest. Of course, there was also vandalism, which happens in virtually every protest in the world. In Europe, you have vandalism when there are massive protests. So that's part of it. And then I also think some violence was, or I don't think, we know, some violence was triggered by state violence. And we also know that happens in protests around the world, right? So when there is a violent response from the state, that triggers additional episodes of violence. Another question that you mentioned, do we underestimate the role of emotions? I think in general, we underestimate the role of emotions when we study social and political phenomena. But I think in these cases, it's very clear that this is very important. The feeling of outrage really pushed people to the streets. And that, I think, was clear in a lot of the pictures that Marcela was showing, which I agree with Mauricio, could be pictures of Colombia. There is a lot of just the visibility of this outrage and the need to express, right? So I don't think the protests are just people thinking this will change things, although there is a lot of that, which I think is interesting and positive. But there is always also this need of expression. And this says a lot, these emotions say a lot, and I'll connect this to another topic that was mentioned, and it's the crisis of governance and of democracy and of institutions that we're seeing. And Andres was saying that the political scientists really focus on the economic parts, but I don't think so. I think we both really also mentioned the crisis of democracy and the lack of trust in institutions. I think that's very clear and it's very worrying, right? And if you look at the data that Andres mentioned and more data, we know not just that people in Latin America are not trusting all kinds of institutions, but also that they are not valuing democracy. It's really scary when you look at the different data that ask questions about not even just do you like democracy, but just what democracy means. No? Do you want a government that follows, you know, the rule of law? Do you want, are you okay with the government controlling the media or not having free press? And the responses are, I mean, you can't believe this is a country that 2 or 3 decades ago was still battling with dictatorship. So there is a very big crisis of the status quo, of the political status quo. And again, I think the emotions that you see in the streets are a very good signal of that. I will tackle a couple more things. So the world patterns, I think, Andres, I agree with a lot of what you said, and if we're really trying to think of this as a social scientists, we are trying to understand both the seemingly unexpected nature of these protests and the fact that, as I said in my presentation, we have these really long-term grievances, but then suddenly people are really asking for change. Why now, right? And so I think there is this pattern in the world of unrest, and I do think we have to be able to find reasons to help understand that. At the same time, it is very possible that you have shared repertoires for action, shared ideals of how to, what things to pay attention to if you're a citizen in Europe or in Latin America or in Africa, what to pay attention to, and what are sort of the accepted, legitimate ways of expressing your concerns or your disagreements. And I do think that the radical changes in how communication takes place across boundaries, across continents, is doing something, right? So people are aware of what is happening in other places. People are aware of how the international community responds to inequality, injustice, but also how legitimate it's seen in most of the world that people actually go to the streets to protest. And the Arab Spring was one chapter of that, right? So I think people are sharing repertoires of action, of understanding, of topics to focus on. For example, I think what has happened with racism in the US has accelerated and facilitated a lot of discussions in Latin America. Not because we didn't have racism before, of course, it's been there always, but now we have these additional tools to pay attention to it and talk about it. So I think there are heterogeneous structural changes globally that are creating new losers and winners and that are sending the message to people that they, for example, in the developed world, that they want do as well as previous generations, and that is creating different kinds of unrest. And so there may be these different structural reasons why you see all this unrest, but there may be at the same time these more homogeneous ways of understanding political reality and for social action. And I think that the last thing I would say it's about elections. So how can this shape elections in Colombia? I will just say two things because I know we don't have a lot of time. The one is that no political campaign can ignore these topics. It's in people's minds. People expect them to talk about them, to talk about inequality, to talk about even police brutality. Even the right wing parties will have to talk about state violence. But at the same time, I think the nature and the emotion of these topics really create a fertile ground for horrible populism. And we don't know how this is going to play out. It's very easy also with social media and misinformation to manipulate easy go-to responses to these problems, to put everything like very different phenomenon problems in one basket and use simplistic labels that mobilize emotions. And I think we are in a very difficult moment. I think it's very easy for this to just facilitate populism, easy solutions that sell, you know, sell easy messages, but that won't really get us the reforms that this country's made. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Anna. Marcela, if you'd like to come in, please. And if you could keep it to 3-4 minutes, that would be terrific.
I'll really try. I think one of the, I just wanted to dissent with something I addressed, at least on my part, and what I try to, what I'll try to say, and also the work that we've been doing at UNDP, is that I think that the problem in Chile was fundamentally political. You know, you had the sort of material conditions of inequality, but they were triggered by, you know, an institutional system that lost the capacity to intermediate or represent political parties that are completely, you know, that have lost the trust of citizens, an elite that sort of is self-absorbed and consumed by their own interest. And I think that sort of the, as we say in Chile, the cherry of the cake was this, you know, 5 years in a row of scandals of corruption and, you know, abuses, you know, illegal funding of politics, collusions, etc. So I also, you know, and I think there's a long sort of history of research on this, is that a protest is that dynamic relationship between the way that the state reacts and how society, you know, interacts with that reaction. So the way that different states react to protests can, you know, produce different kinds, they can sort of produce, you know, an increase of protests, or they can kind of, you know, handle them to decompress pressure. And I think that probably in both countries, the examples here were, you know, authorities that did not have the capacity of confronting the problems, and they probably exacerbated them. In the case of Chile, it was obvious that the extreme reaction of repression really extended and brought even more issues to the table that are continued till now. Like one of the pending issues of the revolt are probably not what really triggered them, you know, but what happened within that process, you know, the amount of people in jail without sentences, you know, the amount of people that lost sight, people killed, people raped, you know, and a very slow and to say it politely in terms of the administration of justice in this sense. In terms of violence, I do think that there is no violence in the singular. You know, we have the phenomenon of violence is really complex. The state exacerbates, and mainstream media exacerbate only one type of violence, but they're really blind to other types of violence. And I think also we have a really, not just emotions, but a really kind of, you know, a crash of priorities, of moral priorities between common citizens and part of the elite. You know, for the elites, the burning of the subway is sort of an affront that probably will never be forgiven. You know, not that I don't, you know, think that burning a subway station is bad, but for important sectors of Chilean society, having blind youth, it's probably much worse. And when you cannot reconcile those, you know, normative values, I think one of the problems in Chile, I think, and the last 2 years has shown us that I think we have failed as a society to really consolidate the defense of human rights. And this is probably the true of other Latin American countries, to consolidate the respect of human rights as something that should be nonpartisan. You know, we did not win that fight. You know, in Chile, speaking of human rights or defense of human rights is perceived as partisan. And I think that is a problem that we really need to tackle with. And to end, in terms of the election, you know, something that we didn't have time to discuss, but we have been doing around focus groups every 3 or 4 months at UNDP. And what we've seen is that the revolt is not lost, but it's been confounded with the impact of COVID. So in people's minds, this is perceived as sort of one single crisis. You know, this is, it was kind of, you know, the social revolt with the COVID pandemic. It's kind of has transformed people's lives, the use of public space, you know, their economic conditions, their relationships with society. So in increasingly the imaginary of common people is this is kind of together. And it's really difficult, I think, to separate the impact of the social revolt in politics if we hadn't had the pandemic. You know, it's just impossible to do the counterfactual. What would have happened if, you know, with politics and with, because if we had had the plebiscite for the constitutional process in April of 2020, when it was scheduled, you know, I think would be in a completely different political scenario if it hadn't, you know, if the whole constitutional itinerary hadn't coincided with the normal electoral calendar. So I do think that the pandemic sort of de-rooted a political process, de-rooted the capacity of elites to respond to protests. So a lot of the issues that were presented were not addressed. The constitutional process is something that was there before the revolt, you know, something, you know, 34 years in the making. But if it hadn't been for the revolt, we wouldn't have a new constitution. You know, nobody can doubt that. We would have never had a constitutional process was it not for that massive protest. And I do think that, and just to with respect to Mauricio, I continue to be I continue to be optimistic. I think that the constitutional process is probably one of the few window of opportunities that we have to de-root the relationship between citizens and elites and the representative democracy and society. So I'm putting all my chips and my time to in this process.
Thank you, Marcela. It just remains for me to thank everybody, all the speakers, for 2 fabulous presentations and wonderful comments. It's such a sort of gripping topic and such an important one that is going to have profound implications for a considerable period to come. As we know, if they've been long in the making, they're going to be long in their legacy. I'm glad Andres and I share a like for Albert Hirschman. He also said once something along the lines of anybody who expects all good things to come together needs to be prepared for disappointment. However, following this event, we move straight into another one to overburden people with expectations of good things. And Mauricio and Andres will be commenting and chairing respectively on presentations by Juan Manuel Santos and Ricardo Lagos, as well as with Manu Shafiq, the LSC director, in about 10 minutes or so. Without pause, I just want to thank all the speakers again. This will be available as a podcast through our social media. Please do follow LSE School of Public Policy and the Latin America Center. And well done, everybody. Thank you very much. Enjoy your evening, day, morning, wherever you are. And hope to see everybody soon.
Thank you for the invitation. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.